Hi, I'm Leela Ainge. I'm a psychologist, researcher, and somebody who's been thinking a lot lately about what really makes life feel good. Welcome back to Psychologically Speaking, a podcast all about human behaviour, bringing together fascinating research, insights, and real life experiences. This season, we're exploring joy and how joy actually moves through our lives, how it shifts us and what it makes us do. Today, we're going to explore the difference between happiness and joy and the relief of joyful activities, but also the weight of joy. And we'll think about the way in which psychologists explain joy, some of the limitations in the way that we look at it, and how philosophy fills some of those gaps. And I also want to introduce a paper that's just been published on autistic joy as a different way of thinking about deep enjoyment. In psychology, joy is a really positive emotion. It's most often studied with the idea of this positive psychology. In psychology, there's this historical divide in the study of what is wrong with humans or how we pathologize people into conditions. And then you had the emergence of this idea of positive psychology, which was this idea that we should concentrate on looking at the idea or the view of human flourishing. And wouldn't that be interesting? You know, what makes us thrive as humans? So joy is often thought of or seen or studied as a state of high arousal. And so it's what we would call positive valence. So like a burst of delight when you see a friendly face in a crowd, or perhaps when you experience your favourite music or you've been at a gig. But joy is really distinguished from happiness. So joy is seen as this fleeting thing, and almost very intense. It can be unexplainable, a phenomenon, whereas happiness we know is more stable and long term. In fact, we know that happiness is more stable, and it's measured at a population level. So things like happiness and life satisfaction are surprisingly stable over our lifetime or our life course. It makes them really good indicators, so good that they're tracked by the UK government, and they look at this along with other factors such as GDP, what our country makes, sells and spends. We're also interested in how happy are we. We know that year on year, trends in happiness, you know, they don't shift a lot, but we will expect to see some shifts with huge kind of national changes. The last one on record that you can see this on the UK Gov website, is the happiness index and what happened over the pandemic years. So we know that obviously happiness took a dip during COVID-19 and then it partially recovered afterwards, but we haven't actually seen a return to pre-pandemic highs. Up until the pandemic, average satisfaction and happiness was increasing. So we know that these types of measures, they don't just capture mood, they're reflecting broader conditions, what else is going on. And I want you to think about that, because we're going to come back to this idea of joy as something that is studied or thought about in isolation of other factors. So when we think in psychology about joy, we tend to theorize the idea that joy is a bit of an enabler, because it expands our attention and builds long-term resources. So the more that we broaden our horizons, the more joy we invite into our life. You've got flow theory, which is Csikszentmihalyi. He wrote the famous book on flow. And, you know, really what we learn from that is that flow can emerge from this deep immersion, this flow state. And his research really looked at the idea that you get flow in that intersection where challenge and skill are balanced out. So you don't want something that's too easy. You don't want something that's too difficult. But when there's just enough challenge and you've got just enough skill in that process, then that's where joy will happen, or flow will happen. Self-determination theory is interesting, how joy arises when our basic needs for three things are met: autonomy, competence, and relatedness. that relatedness. We could think about that in terms of our relationships with people, our social needs, competence. So where Csikszentmihalyi was talking about flow theory and skill, competence, have we got skill in what we want to do, and autonomy, if we got some say in how we do what we do. All of these theories are really useful to think about emotion and well-being and motivation. Essentially, you know, they can help us to understand those really practical ways in which we can increase joy through things like play and purpose and social connection with other peoples. But there's a limitation of these psychological theories, and they tend to be quite individualistic, and they're not looked at in terms of context. So they're not always capturing things like our embodied emotions, sensory or environmental factors. In fact, you could say that they're often kind of assuming this universal or this emotional experience that is standard across most people, and that might not fit neurodivergent people. A researcher at the University of Birmingham, Elliot Wassell, and they've researched the experiences of autistic joy. And the reason this landed on my in my emails really is because the researchers used a community to recruit their participants. So we know that these people are already part of an affirming community for neurodivergence. But the study really flips the script or these ideas about how we typically talk about autism, because instead of focusing on struggle, this research really saying, well, what brings autistic people joy? And the researcher themselves is an autistic academic, so they've centred this research from that autistic voice. They wanted to challenge this historical view of pathologizing. A lot of studies around autism are very much, you know, deficit or, you know, loss or difficulty. So they looked at 86 autistic adults, mostly women, non-binary participants. It was autistic-led and a participatory study. This is centred on autistic voices rather than observing from the outside. And we look at these things as markers of good open study in science. So the key question was, what does bring autistic people joy? And what gets in the way of joy as well? Autistic joy is often ignored. It's possibly seen as something quirky or weird or a regulation strategy. It's powerful, it's underexplored. So he looks at philosophical ideas to show that joy isn't just a fleeting moment. And isn't that interesting? Because what we said right at the beginning of this podcast was that joy is often seen as a fleeting moment, something that happens as a bit of a spontaneous or a phenomenal thing or in a state of flow. And it's not as stable as happiness. So this research is saying, isn't saying, how do we fix autism? It's like, well, what if we created environments where autistic people can thrive? I think one of the really joyful things about the research is that it shows just how joy happens. And the themes that emerged were things like sensory pleasure, so, you know, colours and music and swinging movements, the deep absorption, which I think you may have seen this written as monotropism. So it's thought of as almost like a medical term of a focused flow state. Also how repetition and ritual bring comfort and delight. And I think about this a lot, actually. I think perhaps in previous generations, people had ritual in their life, possibly more than we have ritual now as adults. And if you think about self-determination theory, it talks about our need for autonomy. And autonomy would say that we want to move away from, you know, regulation or ritual. We might want to go our own path and do our own thing. But what we're saying here is that structure and ritual actually are quite joyful as well. The research is also showing that things like special interests, so trains, animals, crafts, you know, these are all sources of joy. But the right conditions mattered. So the research says that quiet spaces, supportive relationships and freedom from social pressure. The real barriers, so what prevents joy, that wasn't described by the participants as autism. So autism in itself wasn't stifling joy, but it's other people's lack of acceptance. I suppose there's a deeper insight. The study is showing that this isn't in spite of being autistic, that people can experience joy. And I'm going to come back to that idea of in spite of later on. But it supports this neurodiversity paradigm, the idea that there's natural variation in our human experience and it's not something to be cured. So an act of almost resistance, it's radical to be who you are in a world that expects people to conform. And being visibly joyful through stimming and deep focus and immersion in niche passions can be really liberating. But it also comes with that warning of it might not be accepted in every single kind of circumstance. It's just a fantastic paper. But if you're autistic or neurodivergent or just curious about what it looks like to flourish, I suppose, on the margins, this paper's asking us to rethink how we think about joy, how it's experienced, how it's expressed, and a reminder that it's not just a personal thing. One of the theories then that the researcher is using is a philosophical one called assemblage theory. I really like the way that it uses this theory to understand the world not as fixed categories. And I think anybody who, say if you've got children or you are neurodivergent or you're around neurodivergent people, this idea of labeling being both a curse and a blessing sometimes. You need labels in order to get through systems and to get support you need. Labels can be really affirming and identity rich, but labels can also be pathologizing and they can be unhelpful and they can be used to, as a social scientist, we say to denote an in-group and an out-group, which can have both positive and negative outcomes. But this idea of assemblage theory is saying that if we move away from fixed categories and understanding how complex systems are made up of many interacting parts. And I think that's such a human way to think about how we can coexist in multiple identities, this intersectionality, if you like. The research is really saying when all of parts and your environment come together in the moment, that is assemblage. That includes things like your sensory experiences, your body, your brain, the music you're listening to. Could be the cat on your lap, memories, the room you're in, the weather, past trauma. It could even be your favourite mug that you have your tea in. But all of these things create this kind of temporary situation. And one philosopher, Deleuze, called that a territory of becoming. I think the key things to take from this paper is this person in the right environment, doing what they love, surrounded by people who get them? And I would say that's possibly at the heart of my research questions as a social scientist and a social psychologist is, how do people flourish in the right environment and what's that right environment? But let's go back to Maslow for a little bit, because his hierarchy needs is one of those enduring theories. It's been replaced by self-determination theory, largely, in psychological circles. This triangle, the bottom, you've got basic needs like safety, food, water, for example. And then as you move up the triangle, the hierarchy, you can get to this area of self-actualization. And, you know, quite a few people have hypothesized that some people may never get there. But I want to challenge this idea that joy is a pinnacle of success, or that transcendence, if you like, that Maslow was talking about, and that joy can coexist with emotional weight too. And turn to two portraits in the National Portrait Gallery to explain this idea of emotional weight. If you want to see these images for yourself, then head to www.leilaainge, so that's leilaainge.co.uk/joy. I've uploaded the images that I've taken and full links to the artists and their websites for you to enjoy. Both of these portraits are free to view at the National Portrait Gallery in London. It is a child-friendly place. So last weekend, I was at the Oasis concert, and in itself, it was one of the most joyful experiences I have had in the last 2 decades. A number of things made it really joyful. Being with my husband, singing with 90,000 other people. We know that music and singing in psychology is rich for joy. But Monday morning came and the joy had left the building. And after a very good breakfast, we had time to kill. So we decided we'd go to the other end of the cultural spectrum from Wembley Stadium to an art gallery. And I'm going to describe the image that first caught my attention. So this is by an artist called Evadne Davis. It's a self-portrait and she sat on a brown sofa to one side and she looks visibly exhausted. She's in this pink kind of two-piece, you know, kind of loungewear suit with a red design on it. And you can see the weight of tiredness on this individual. But what makes this so striking is in the background, you've got this child who's in movement and they are what looks like running across the back of the sofa. And I want you to imagine a small child running across the back of a sofa and squashing down those back sofa cushions. And I was drawn to this because it's the summer holidays and I feel like I'm constantly moving around my own house and refluffing up pillows and putting things back in place. But also it was just such a relatable image. It's something I remember doing myself as a child, pulling things off the sofa and playing on a sofa and having that joy. And so you've got this self-portrait of what we presume is the mother and the child, mother exhausted, child playing, you know, joyfully in the background. Well, that's how I've interpreted it. There was a nostalgic element for this for me too, because it was a brown sofa. There was a brown sofa in my childhood and I could remember the texture of this like kind of velour, velvety type of sofa and just the memory of messing around and playing. And this child's in this bright red kind of party dress. The thing that brought me the most joy about this picture is when I got closer. So I walked into the gallery to read the caption. The title of this piece by Evadne Davis is called Inset Day. And I thought, well, isn't that just amazing? You know, I've been talking this year about the fact that adults need their own inset day. And here's a picture that describes, I suppose, the weight and the tension and the joy of being a parent, of holding space for that child to have that joyful experience while you're sat there looking utterly exhausted and like you've got the weight of the world on your face. And there were some things that made me think about the weight of joy. It's the idea that joy coexists around tiredness and exhaustion. The second piece of art then was it's a portrait by the actor, Cush Jumbo. And she's most well known in the UK for playing Lady Macbeth alongside David Tennant in the theatre. And she was also in a brilliant TV series called The Good Fight. The Good Fight, an American TV series, was described as a controlled explosion of fury at the Trump era by the journalist Lucy Mangan. And it also stars Christine Baranski. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, it's very satire. I would go and give that a watch. But this portrait of Cush Jumbo is by Zoe Buchman. And what you see is a piece of vintage textile. And it looked to me to be like an old cushion with a scalloped edge. And then on top of this, the artist has embroidered in line embroidery Cush Jumbo's portrait. The really interesting thing is, you know, there are threads hanging. And I thought that was quite interesting. The idea that, you know, it was undone, that it was not quite finished, if you like, or that these lines were still, you know, ready to be sewn in. And I thought that was quite interesting from a portrait perspective. But then when you read the caption next to this piece, and the title of it is called Why Don't You Just Tell Me How You Want Me to Be, Baby? And I'll live like water around you. And so Zoe is saying that this is part of a series of portraits. She's saying that this series of portraits were really celebrating the idea of women's capacity to go through experiences such as miscarriage and violence and yet to still choose joy. And I thought that it is a choice, isn't it? And in contrast to the other piece and how parenting is tough and it's hard, but it's simultaneously joyful. Parenthood is one of those unique experiences that can make you feel like you've been in a car crash whilst marvelling at the awe and wonder of tiny toes in the next moment. Zoe Buchman was kind of saying that these portraits were showing that. When I went home, I looked up the work of Evadne Davis, because I really, really enjoyed that piece. She's done a series of oil paintings on vintage wallpaper. And then you've got Zoe Bookman, who's also using vintage textile. So it was interesting that they're both using old textiles, or thinking about, both artists are using old textiles in their work. In today's podcast, we've explored joy, not just as a fleeting emotional high, but something that's really textured and meaningful, and, you know, it's sometimes heavy. We looked at how psychology frames joy through theories like broaden and build and flow, how theories such as Maslow's hierarchy of needs might fall a bit short in understanding how joy really coexists in our environment. We looked at the emerging philosophical views and research in neurodivergent areas of joy being very relational and situational. And we looked at that assemblage theory. And I like the idea that, you know, that new research challenges the idea that joy only comes from people once people are fixed, that our basic needs, all of these like kind of layers of life, need to be perfectly in place to experience joy. You know, who gets to decide that? We get to choose joy, I think is what I'm taking from Zoe Bookman's work here. So in reflecting on those two artworks from the National Portrait Gallery, I thought about the emotional weight of joy and how it coexists with tiredness, grief, duty, you know, history. It weaves through everything. The coaching prompt or reflection for today: where in your life is joy? Where in life is joy showing up with weight? Is there a moment, a memory, or an experience where joy coexists with responsibility, exhaustion, or contradiction? What happens then if you stop waiting for joy to feel light and start thinking about the version of joy that is with you with weight? And you might want to journal this, or think about it, or simply notice it in your everyday life. You know, for me, it looks a little bit like coming out to the pavilion and having a coffee when I've got a to-do list, you know, longer than my shopping list. Or the joy of being with your kid, even when they're moaning about being bored. Thank you for listening to this episode of Psychologically Speaking. I'm Leela Ainge, your host, and we have explored the weight of joy, art, and traditional narratives of joy as being something that we should aim to achieve at the end of a destination. I'm saying you can choose joy at every part of your journey. A quick reminder that for today's episode, I've uploaded the photos and links to the galleries and artist work on my website, which is www.leelaainge.co.uk/joy. And my wonderful sister has managed to source a picture of that sofa. So you also get to see a picture of me as a small child.